Bing bong. I am back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I'm joined by the plate licking pleb. He's a Canadian, so I've had a few Canadians on this show before, and many of you listening are in fact Canadian as well. And so we get into some big news, a big meetup going on in July 16th in Toronto. The details have not been officially released yet, so be sure to follow at plate liquor underscore 21M on Twitter in order to get that information and those updates. And I know my buddies over at the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast will also go into that. So be sure to listen and stay tuned for more updates. But we get into the plate liquor's experience in Bitcoin, how he's helping organize a big meetup. Also, he is a financial advisor. So we kind of talk about how the worlds mesh and don't mesh. So it's a pretty interesting conversation there. Then we get into some current event stories. We get into the Bitcoin partisan bill introduced by Senator Lummis, the New York State advancing a bill to essentially put a 2-year moratorium on Bitcoin mining, Block partnering with Apple to implement tap to pay and the potential implications, what that can mean for Bitcoin. Edge releasing the first confidential Bitcoin Mastercard. And it comes out during this podcast that Mastercard is now not being released. So we could see a quick 24-hour turnaround from that initial non-KYC Mastercard being released. But alas, we give our opinions on something of that technology. PayPal allowing users to remove Bitcoin from the platform, and lastly, 105 countries exploring the use of CBDCs. So we got a jam-packed episode. It ran for a good 90 minutes, so be sure to give it a listen to the whole thing. And as always, this is not financial advice, not financial advice, not financial advice, strictly for entertainment purposes only. Now let's get into the show. Whoosh. Bing bong. I am live with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast. But before I get started, I want to thank Mynode for assisting me in getting the podcasting 2.0 set up. So if you guys are listening to this on YouTube or have heard about it before or want to, donate some sats, feel free to catch me on any one of these podcasting 2.0 apps. And now I have a very special guest. He's in the waiting room right now waiting for me, but it's the plate licking pleb. We've interacted a little bit on Twitter, and he's done some awesome stuff. So plate licker, how you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Of course, of course. So first, I gotta ask a question. How did you come up with the plate licking pleb?
Well, that was I always actually just liked the whole idea of the plebeian class and being a pleb and kind of just how that's kind of how Bitcoin's growing from the ground up and everything like that. So one day I just Googled what a pleb was, and the actual they give an explanation of like an example of a plebeian act would be licking your plate. So I thought that was hilarious, and I actually do lick my plates all the time. I don't know why. I guess growing up poor or something. So I figured it was a very fitting name, and it's easy to remember. So I changed it a couple months ago.
There you go. That's awesome. That's awesome. So I think we first interacted. You might have mentioned it to me, but you are in your bio, you said you're from Canada, and I know that you're running a Bitcoin meetup or at least helping out in the Bitcoin meetup area. You want to go into a little bit of like how you're doing? Because I know that the Bitcoin scene in Canada is growing pretty rapidly. We got my buddies Joey and Len at the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast, and I got a lot of Canadian listeners here too. So, where's the meetup, and like how's it doing? How's it get where's it at, and all the details and everything like that.
Yeah, so that's another one of my favorite parts about Bitcoin is just meeting up with the plebs too. I know Joey and Len. I love the Bitcoiners podcast in Canada too. We've actually done all different locations for the meetup. So we did one in Hamilton at the Tahini's there. We did one in Whitby. And then the next one is next month, which is July 16th, which is a Saturday. And that's going to be in Toronto. The exact bar or pub is not quite determined, but it's a Saturday. It'll probably be 2 to 5 p.m. We have some big people coming as far as speakers, some famous people from Twitter and YouTube and the Bitcoin world. I think the big thing to note for that meetup is there's going to be a massive announcement, essentially, which is a big deal for Canadian Bitcoiners in the Canadian Bitcoin scene. I'm really excited about it. I got involved, don't ask me how, it's kind of like by serendipity or luck that I happened to get involved, but I'm very happy to be, I'm proud to be involved, and I'm really looking forward to telling everybody about it.
That's awesome. That's awesome stuff. So yeah, I mean, it sounds like you're kind of got into the Canadian Bitcoin scene there. So how, first, let's back it up a little bit. So tell us a little bit about your orange pill story. Like, how did you get involved in Bitcoin? And then, you know, how did you kind of get started in Bitcoin Twitter?
Yeah, so I guess Bitcoin is kind of gravitated towards Bitcoin, kind of growing up being maybe anti-establishment and kind of counterculture and hating authority and hating my teachers and doing terribly in school. And that translated into hating the government and realizing maybe I'm a libertarian, things like that. So I heard about Bitcoin in, I think, like 2013 with the whole Mt. Gox thing. Didn't think much about it. A couple of years later, I had a friend suggest that we pool our resources and start mining. At the time, I said, okay, that's too risky. I don't know how to do that. Sounds risky. Sounds like a scam. So I didn't actually really get involved with Bitcoin until late 2020. Like October 2020 is when I first bought some Bitcoin. And that was just because the app that I used for investing in stock picking and everything like that happened to offer Bitcoin. So as soon as I put $100 in, it went up in value right October 2020, right? So I'm thinking, oh, wow, maybe there is something to this. Maybe I should do some research about this. And so looking at all the YouTube scammers and shitcoiners and stuff like that led to Twitter, and just one by one following one person I heard of, they retweet stuff from other people. And then I find myself, okay, I'm only following Bitcoiners. I'm unfollowing anyone who's not tweeting about Bitcoin. And it just kind of rolls from there. And eventually it's like, eventually you're going to be a Bitcoin maximalist if you kind of go that route.
Yeah. Bitcoin Twitter is a wild place, but, everybody seems connected, and then, going at the shitcoiners too. So I think you get kind of a good filter when you follow some good Bitcoin maxis too. So, awesome stuff. Awesome stuff. So you have in your Twitter bio that you're a financial advisor. So how has that kind of, I guess, affected your view on Bitcoin? Were you kind of jaded at the beginning, or were you more like open to the idea?
So in 2017, when there's the big price run-up, the company that I work for actually kind of put out a statement to all the advisors and said, like, okay, a lot of clients are asking about this. This is what you say. There's nothing backing it. It's very risky. There's no CEO or board of directors to hold accountable. So kind of be careful, invest at your own risk. And we don't recommend it, basically. And I took that exactly at face value. So I kind of memorized that and said, okay, yep, that's the truth. I'll tell that to my clients. And then so really once we started hitting all-time highs again after what was supposed to be the peak in the tulip craze, finally ending in 2017, 2018. When we resurpassed that in 2021, it was really like, okay, that's wrong. Something here is correct. And I think that my background in finance and just knowing a lot about the economy and how the Fed works, how the Bank of Canada works, I think that really helped me grasp Bitcoin a lot quicker because I already had a lot of the background knowledge. And I think what I was jaded about was the government and knowing, okay, how is the government spending all this money, right? And going further and further into debt. In Canada, taxes really haven't went up too much at all in the past 7 years or so. I couldn't get that straight in my mind of like, how is this whole system not just blowing up? So what Bitcoin clicked for me was, oh, it's the currency. That's why inflation is what it is. Inflation isn't 2%. That's why houses in my area have quadrupled in the past 10 years. I had the foundation already there, and then Bitcoin helped the final thing to click. And now it's like, okay, now my worldview makes sense. And that feels good for someone to all of a sudden, when life makes sense again. I think that really cemented my maximalism as well.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, I think like everybody kind of has that moment when you first go and go down the rabbit hole in Bitcoin where everything just kind of clicks like, okay, wait, the status quo really doesn't make, you know, that much sense. So I think that's awesome that you think that your financial advisor background kind of helped you with that, because I feel like now a lot of financial advisors are kind of coming around to it. But they still don't fully understand it. They just see that, you know, Bitcoin and I've talked to a couple in like my other podcast too, and they always mention Ethereum too, because they say like, those are the two biggest market cap ones. So they're not going away. They don't really understand the underlying technology, but it seems like you have actually gone down the rabbit hole and understand the technology and everything like that too. And you know, the fundamentals and all that as well. So how has that gone with your profession now? Are you like advising some of your clients now to, purchase Bitcoin, or are like people at your clients asking you about it? Or can you even disclose anything like that?
Yeah. So part of the reason why my name is Plate Licker, so I can talk about that stuff and not lose my job. So in 2017, I had one client ask me about Dash, because they heard from a relative. In 2020 and 2021, I had about 6 or 8 clients ask me about Bitcoin, right? So I think in the that's my anecdotal evidence that even the normies are kind of getting that maybe Bitcoin is the one to be focusing on. So I'm actually not allowed to tell someone to buy Bitcoin. That would be considered in my line of business of giving advice to buy an individual security, which I'm not allowed to do. I could get a certain license, which is called an IROC license in Canada, and then I could sell like some of the Bitcoin ETFs that we have. But as it stands now, I'm not allowed to talk about it with clients. That being said, even though I'm a legacy financial advisor, I do have some integrity. So a lot of the clients that I think can understand Bitcoin enough to be able to hodl and not freak out if it dips, I tell them about it. And I give them a very clear description of the volatility so that they can prepare for it. Because the last thing that you want is you tell a client, okay, yeah, put 3 to 5% into Bitcoin. And then they sell once it drops 30%, right? Because then I'm a terrible advisor, right? So I do have to pick and choose who I tell about Bitcoin, but it's usually my biggest, most trusted clients that have some wherewithal about them as far as understanding markets and understanding why Bitcoin makes sense in the first place. But it definitely does kind of irk me, because I find some of the people who need Bitcoin the most, for example, later this month, I have to go see a client of mine who's in her late 70s. She has a 100% bond portfolio because she's terrified of volatility, right? Now, she doesn't really have the wits about her for me to be able to explain that, like, yes, bonds are traditionally safe and are supposed to be safe, but there is A, inflation risk, B, default risk, right? It's hard for people to understand that, like, Canada could default on its debt. How is that possible, right? So that, in my opinion, that's someone who needs Bitcoin the most. Even if it's a 3% allocation, I think in the next 10 years, that could really be a lifesaver for someone like that. But I can't tell her about it, right? So that's kind of why I go hard in on Bitcoin Twitter is because I'm preparing myself knowing that my job's not going to be around in the same capacity it is now in 10 years, right? So I kind of, I need to have some other connections, I think, in the correct industry.
Yeah, I gotcha. That makes sense. So I know, like, traditionally in, like, you know, the traditional finance world, they do say the 60-40 portfolio. Now, what is your view on that? Do you kind of, like, you know, for somebody like you just said, where they have 100% in bonds, would you try to, like, even, like, sway them just to get to the 60-40 portfolio? I mean, I get that that's better than the 100%, but what do you think, I guess, like, the new age portfolio is? Is it like 60-40 stocks and bonds, or 60-40 stocks and Bitcoin? Like, what kind of, I guess, is your view on just overall portfolio structure, how that's kind of going?
Yeah, you know, thanks for asking about that. I think that's an extremely common misconception when people think about investing and kind of like mainstream investing with financial advisors and mutual funds and things like that. Because the 60-40 portfolio, that would be considered like a moderate risk portfolio, right? Middle of the road. I'm only allowed to invest my clients in a 60-40 portfolio after we complete a 14 question risk questionnaire that kind of says, like, okay, if you had a $100,000 portfolio and it were to fall, at what point would you panic? And then they say, okay, would you panic at 90,000? Would you panic at 80,000, 70,000? And basically it's like one of those personality questionnaires where each question you get like 2 points for, or 3 points, depending on how you answer. And then however that questionnaire spits out the results, how many points you have at the end, that determines where I'm allowed to invest that client, right? So there's a lot of factors that play into it. But so a lot of people go into 60-40 because of that, the moderate risk. But if they don't want to see a 20% loss in their portfolio, they can't handle a 60-40. That's too risky, too volatile for them. So if they would be calling me in a panic at a 20% loss, that means that they should be moderate conservative, which is 55% bonds, 45% stocks. If they're even more conservative, they don't want to see a 10% drop. That means they're going to be 70% bonds, 30% stocks, right? And then the other way, you could be like a moderate aggressive investor, which is common too, which is like 80-20, 20% bonds. And then aggressive would be 10 or 0% allocation to bonds. So 60-40, I think that's kind of just like a saying almost. It is common. It's the most common one because a lot of people don't know how to answer these types of questions. So they just pick the middle answer for everyone. So that spits them out at 60-40. But you definitely see a whole spectrum of people who are far more conservative and far less conservative.
Yeah, so Joey's in the chat, and from the Canadian Bitcoiners, and he's like, isn't it wild that clients aren't allowed to invest on their own in some cases, but because they presumably don't know enough, but then they're dictating the pros how their money is deployed. And I think that's a very interesting point as well, because I agree with that, because I feel like it's very difficult to answer that question of, you know, how much volatility can you handle? Because essentially it's like, how much do I trust you? Because they don't understand like what they're investing in. Like a lot of times, right, they're just trusting you to kind of invest in their money. Whereas like, you know, if they maybe, you know, I guess look into their investments or kind of have that conviction, that's when they can kind of handle those swings. So I feel like, I don't know, like you kind of selling them on the investments or however you want to word it, you know, advising them on the investments that you would, you know, how the portfolio structure and everything like that, I feel like that would kind of dictate how much risk I'd like to take, if that makes sense. Like kind of the reverse, whereas like, okay, you know, maybe I don't understand Bitcoin at first, and then you explain it to me, I'm like, okay. And then as we get farther along into it and I kind of do my own research, I'm like, okay, you know, I can understand and I can handle these 50, 60% drawdowns because I believe in Bitcoin long term. But like if you just told me about it for the first time and all I know about it is like it's magic internet money, if it drops 10%, I'm going to probably be freaking out. So have you kind of like experienced that in your own realm as well?
Yeah. So, so I guess just to address Joey's question there, or his thought there, I would say the big reason for that and why it's done that way is just to protect my company's ass, really. Because then we can say, oh, you're scared of this 20% dip, but you answered your personality quiz this way, so you said you were okay with it, right? So it's kind of taking the liability off of us and putting it onto them. So it's really not the most honest way to be doing that, in my opinion. But it's the reality that we face, is that even though I'm an advisor, there's some things I'm technically not supposed to be advising on, right? People will ask me, hey, so which one do you think I should be, moderate or aggressive? And I know what I think in my head, but I have to say, oh, I can't make that decision. All I can do is explain to you your options and let you pick for yourself. And then as far as teaching people about Bitcoin, I serve about 125 families, right? Which is really low compared to most financial advisors. If you go to a bank, the average advisor has like 2,000 or 3,000 families that they take care of. I keep it very low, and I kind of go higher net worth, right? And the idea is then I can spend more time with each family, right? But that being said, even with that few amount of clients, it's hard to explain everything that they need to know, right? Because we have to talk about taxes, we have to talk about life insurance, right? We have to talk about investing, we have to talk about their kids' education, everything like that, right? There's just so many hours in the day. So really giving them that level of education is actually not really feasible. What it would have to be is kind of educating close friends that much, right? And really getting them to understand Bitcoin so that they know how to hodl. Most people, you got to be careful educating about Bitcoin and then leaving them to their own devices, because then they'll end up in fucking Dogecoin or something like that in 2 weeks later, right? So I really had to be careful with that too, because for this old lady, for example, I do believe that her 100% bond portfolio will treat her better than any allocation of Dogecoin. So I do have to be a little careful on that front as well. Does that answer the question, or did I go on a different tangent?
No, that answers the question for sure. So before we get into the current event stories, I got to ask, you have a guitar behind you. So how much do you shred, and what's your favorite track to lay on the guitar?
So you might've seen some tweets from me, but I play almost exclusively the Chili Peppers. I've been playing my whole life, pretty much only Chili Peppers nowadays, or I'll make up my own songs that sound like the Chili Peppers. I got a Chili Peppers tattoo, actually. That's my favorite band. That's what I play all the time. Basically, if there's some extra time in the day, or if I'm waiting on hold, if I got to call somebody, I pick that up and strum, Under the Bridge, or, Solo Squeeze, or Can't Stop, or something like that.
There we go. The Peppers are a band, man. They've got some tracks for sure. So I definitely respect that that choice, to say the least. So awesome stuff. Maybe we'll have you. We'll have to have you rip one and post a video of it or something like that, and we'll look at it and get it across Bitcoin Twitter. Or maybe we'll have you. Maybe you should get on stage at one of these meetups and just start ripping some chili peppers on there. I think that would be pretty cool. Get the people going.
I am kind of a douche in that way. Kind of like playing at times that are like somewhat inappropriate. Oftentimes, if like I'm drunk and there's like another band playing and they go and take a break, I'll ask them and say, "Hey, like, can I play a song like during your break?" And half the time they're like, "You're not touching my guitar," but then other times they're like, "Sure, why not?" And so I'm the idiot of this group of friends playing guitar now all of a sudden at the bar. It's I'm always embarrassed the next day, that's for sure.
Hey, that happens. It always happens to me when I get up on stage and sing karaoke really drunk, because then I'll pick some dumb song that I can't read the words fast enough, and I'll embarrass myself too. So I can relate. But let's get into some current event stories. So I know you're Canadian, but a couple of these stories are more like US based, but I feel like they kind of affect the overall Bitcoin ecosystem. And you know, whatever happens in America kind of affects Canada as well. So the first big story, I believe, is that the Bitcoin bipartisan bill. So Senator Cynthia Lummis out of Wyoming, she's a big noted Bitcoiner. I think she's actually working with Jack Maulers on this as well. But her and Kirsten Gillibrand out of New York have been working to write this bill that is intended to encourage, quote, responsible innovation regarding digital assets and Bitcoin. So the bill is called Responsible Financial Innovation Act, and it essentially proposes which regulatory body regulates what. So it's their SEC and the Futures Trading Commission. And what I think is interesting about this bill is that it'll allow for purchases of $200 and less tax-free. So it'll allow you to transact in Bitcoin. And then as well, it kind of forces lawmakers to define the differences between the securities and commodities. So it'll kind of make lawmakers like really look into the background tech of, you know, Bitcoin and these other shit coins. So what is your opinion on, like, I guess, overall regulation of Bitcoin? And how do you kind of see this bill moving forward?
I guess at the end of the day, there is no real regulation for Bitcoin. There's only regulation for the pussy Bitcoiners who will follow the regulations, right? There's no one is regulating my use of Bitcoin, put that way, right? The other thing that jumps out at me most is there really such a thing as irresponsible innovation? I don't think so. If it's irresponsible, then it's not really innovation in my mind. So I thought that was kind of dumb. But overall, I do think this is a good step for Bitcoin, right? Just because it adds legitimacy. And I think we'll kind of touch that on that on a couple of these stories that we're covering today. Bitcoin adoption is held back because there's people who think it's magic internet money, right? They think it's just for nerds and it's not real, right? Half of us can't convince our wives yet that Bitcoin is actually important, right? So that's a big thing. So when they're actually talking about it in places like this, like the US Senate, I think that's a big deal. So I do think it's a plus. I'm not gonna say it. Sorry, I'm seeing Jordab in the chat. Mom walked in at the wrong time. Sorry, Jordab. I don't think this regulation is not good for the world overall, but I do think it's good for Bitcoin because it adds that legitimacy. Bitcoin doesn't need this, right? I don't know who the hell is reporting small Bitcoin transactions anyways, right? I don't, like, anybody who knows Bitcoin enough to be making transactions, if you have a Lightning wallet and you're buying stuff with it or donating to those Tally coins or something like that, if you're that much of a Bitcoin, there's not a chance of reporting this. So I'd like to see how many people actually report those small Bitcoin transactions. But like a sailor always says, regulatory clarity is good, right? So that's what I think about it. Clarity is good for the institutional adoption. Regulations as a whole are bad. I think also the thing about this is Lummis originally was talking about Bitcoin. She mostly talks about Bitcoin. But the fact that she's included 200 other shitcoins, I think clearly she's been bought by my new favorite word, the crypto Ponzi industry. So I don't think it's really a big deal long term that those other cryptos are involved in this. Short term, of course, a lot of noobs are going to get wrecked because if that's adding false legitimacy to the shitcoins, right? So people are going to then say, oh, it's legal, it's just a commodity, whatever, I can buy it, and then they're going to lose their life savings. But long term, I don't think it really matters that the cryptos are involved because it's not like Apple's going to be integrating shitcoins in their Apple Pay, right? They're going to skip through that, but once they see this clarity, they'll skip right to Bitcoin, right? So I think that some people are going to get wrecked because of this, but I think overall it's good for Bitcoin adoption. It's going to speed up Bitcoin adoption in my mind.
Yeah, I agree, and I think like some people are just kind of waiting for more regulation. I think at the end of the day, some more like they think it's like you said, like magic internet money. You have tough times convincing people because, you know, the government doesn't really say it's something safe. Most of the time they kind of make regulations against it. But I think like Lummis is pretty bullish on Bitcoin, but I know that she you know, separated Bitcoin and Ethereum into, you know, one category, and everything else is kind of a security. So I think, you know, overall it's good for Bitcoin. And I think, you know, it'll kind of help more so the companies building around Bitcoin. Just so like, you know, right now they're kind of roaming free. There's a lot of these, you know, shitcoin casinos going on and like being big in the news. And, you know, and I think just overall, a lot of these companies too are kind of like looking for regulations. So once they get taxed or something like that, they're not hit with an unexpected bill or an unexpected tax bill or something along those lines. So granted, I agree with you. I don't think that there's any regulation that's needed, but I think like, you know, lawmakers are not going to let this go by without any regulation eventually. And so that kind of brings me to the next story that I'm going to bring up is the New York State advances another bill to kind of ban Bitcoin mining. So this is like kind of an interesting one because I've heard kind of two sides of the coin on this, which I never thought I really would, but New York State Senate has passed the bill. I think it's S6486D for those that want to go read it, and it'll invoke a 2-year moratorium on Bitcoin and cryptocurrency mining that use proof of work mining. And so basically that's just a straight up just a target at Bitcoin. So it's intended to crack down on Bitcoin mining that's connected to power plants that burn fossil fuels. And so I know that there's been coal plants that have been kind of stopped and brought back to power in order to mine Bitcoin in New York State. But overall, I mean, I just feel like there's no consistency in ESG narrative and all that kind of stuff. So what is your kind of overall opinion on the ESG and like Bitcoin mining using various power sources? Because I know Bitcoin mining is actually, you know, pretty big up in Canada.
So ESG, that's one of those things that for me to give an in-depth answer, I would have to understand all that stuff, which if you're going to ask me about science and global warming and stuff like that, the reality is I don't know. To me, it seems pretty ridiculous on the surface level that us as humans are going to wreck the planet with what we're doing when there's volcanoes and stuff doing much worse all the time, right? But I don't really know the ins and outs of that to talk about ESG too much. I do know that it's definitely being weaponized by policymakers and by governments all around the world. So what I think that this bill really means for Bitcoin is actually a big sign of legitimacy for Bitcoin's where Bitcoin is going to end up at the end of the day, because I don't think that these politicians really think that Bitcoin is ruining the environment, right? New York is obviously the hub for finance, for the legacy finance in the world, right? So I think, to be honest, they're specifically attacking Bitcoin and proof of work because they know that it's replacing half of what they do right now, right? So I think that adds, it makes me feel more certain in what Bitcoin is going to do when this type of stuff happens and when politicians start attacking Bitcoin, because it's like, oh, they know, and that's why they're doing this, right? They know what's happening. So I actually smile every time there's some sort of bill like this proposed. But correct me if I'm wrong, but someone, like, this isn't actually passed yet. Doesn't someone else still have to sign it or something like that?
Yeah, so it's kind of moved through the ranks and it's not officially passed yet, but it's kind of like in the works, and, you know, it kind of seems to be leaning that way that it will be passed. And so, yeah, you're right. It hasn't been, but it's just advanced the bill. And so I agree with you 100%. You know, I think ESG, we got Dan in the chat here saying ESG is just goalposts that are indefinitely moving. And I agree with that statement 100%. So I think in Germany, I want to say, or in another country in Europe, they recently just said that the production of lithium batteries is now, you know, not allowed in that country. And that's what electric vehicles use to drive. So, I mean, now it's like, all right, well, electric vehicles aren't necessarily like green, which is true because, you know, the battery weight waste and everything else. And I think, you know, people don't really think about the amount of power, the amount of like fossil fuels that are used to make like solar panels, like all this kind of stuff is just kind of, you know, promoted as green energy, when in reality, I don't think it's really as self-sustaining and as renewable as people might want to make it out to. It does provide a lot of waste. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think it's like well over half of the Earth's energy is still run on fossil fuels, and it doesn't seem to be going anywhere anytime soon. So I think, you know, like you said, ESG is just kind of being weaponized right now. And it's, yeah, like lawmakers are kind of scared, where they're at the end of the day, just kind of attacking Bitcoin to attack it. And yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting point that you made. I didn't really think about that, about like the legacy financial system, but it all kind of makes sense why they're doing it that way. It just, you know, it is like New York is the one state that seems like really against Bitcoin mining, which I don't really understand, because at the end of the day, like I think in 2021, it was a $15 billion industry. So why wouldn't you want that industry to be in your state and bring a lot of jobs? It doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to me. But, you know, like a lot of politics doesn't always make sense to me as well, too. So I think you're right. I think Bitcoiners are kind of looking into the ESG narrative more and more. And I think a lot of companies, too, are kind of starting to go against it, or at least people are kind of starting to speak up against it. You know, I was at Bitcoin Miami conference, and there was Marty Bent was up on there with a couple CEOs of mining companies, and they kind of talked about bending the knee to this ESG narrative. And Marty got up there and he was like, yeah, you guys need to start standing your ground and say, like, you know, we need to fight this. And I completely agree with him. I think if we, you know, kind of keep bending the knee and just saying, okay, you know, we're going to play nice, you know, it's going to keep getting weaponized, exactly like you're saying. So I kind of hope for, you know, New York, that this bill doesn't go through, but you never know what's really going to happen. So I hope, you know, it kind of follows suit with states like Texas. I know Canada has been pretty friendly to Bitcoin mining as well. So I hope, like, you know, these countries and these states just kind of realize, like, it's such a big industry that it would be financially irresponsible to kind of restrict it like they're doing.
Yeah, and not to mention there's always so many unintended consequences between any type of regulation, right? If we look at what this whole clean energy stuff is doing right now geopolitically, and giving Russia all this power that they otherwise wouldn't have, like if the US was producing as much oil as they could, as much energy as they could, and if Europe was doing the same, then we wouldn't be in quite as bad a position as we are now, right? I think there's just, basically there's nothing good a politician can ever do for the people in the long run. What I want to ask you, though, is, are they actually banning like proof of work for everybody? Like, is this going to affect home miners and stuff like that too?
Yeah, so I don't think it's really going, I mean, I don't think that they could essentially like track that down. I mean, I wouldn't say that they would, you know, go through that full process, but you know, they're claiming it's a moratorium ban for 2 years. My kind of understanding of it too is like it's more so targeted at those that aren't using clean energy. So like I kind of mentioned that there's like coal mines that have been reopened to use that energy to start Bitcoin mining. So I think that these policymakers maybe want to target more of that, opposed to just like the people that are actually using like quote unquote renewable energy. So I'll be interested to see kind of how this develops. I think like a 2-year moratorium, just so they can like figure it out and understand it, isn't the right move, because, you know, like right now is like a great time to kind of get set up, right? Because it's not really in a bull market yet. We're not having the run-ups that we had like maybe a year or so ago. So I think like to get everything kind of settled and up to speed for miners now is like perfect to kind of prepare for the next bull run. So I don't know. I think that's where they're going to target it most, is like more so the quote unquote, like the dirty energy. But I don't think that they would kind of go door to door and knock and be like, hey, I know you're using a Bitcoin miner or something like that. I think those can kind of fly maybe a little bit more under the radar. But yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to kind of see how it develops. Cause like New York State, has kind of, you know, taken a hit too, especially with like COVID, all their policies that they've made. A lot of people are fleeing the state and moving to down south, like friendly states, like Texas, Florida, Tennessee, like all those kind of states too. So, it just is kind of making the state of New York less and less appealing to live in, and which is not good for a state that used to be like, you know, the one of the most powerful states in the country. So, yeah, so let's move on to the next story. So, Jack Dorsey, he's been a great, great Bitcoin advocate. So now he's the CEO of Block. And now Block is partnering with Apple to implement the tap to pay onto their Square terminals. So Square is essentially their point of sale terminals. If you go into a lot of small businesses, they have them there. They have like card readers, and people even have them on their phones and things like that. I know the guy that I get my haircut from, he uses that as well. But right now, tap to pay, you can use Apple Pay on your phone. You can double tap the side, put it close to a register, and have it linked up to a card, and it could accept the payment immediately. And so what I think is kind of interesting about this, and why I think like the logical next step of this is that Apple is going to essentially implement a hot wallet on your phone, whether it's Cash App or something else, where, because you know, you can have your Cash App card be on Apple Pay. You could essentially link that up to some sort of card where instead of, you know, using cash, you can use the option to pay in Bitcoin. And you know, Cash App already uses the Lightning Network, and so I think like right now that they're kind of like working towards that. And so I'll be interested to see the development, but yeah, that's kind of like, I guess my underlying theory and why I wanted to talk about this story is like, what do you think of like Jack Dorsey's overall, you know, outlook on Bitcoin? I don't know if you've been following Block very closely, but they're trying to basically become like a full on ecosystem of, you know, receiving payments, paying, and even like Bitcoin mining and other things like that. So do you kind of see like this route that I'm saying, or do you think like I'm kind of just spitballing and just being a crazy old Bitcoin pleb, just hoping for the best?
Well, Bitcoin plebs are right like 95% of the time. And I think you're right on this one. I think that's definitely the writing on the wall, right? This one, I would say this is the biggest news of the bunch, actually. It's actually even big news, even if it never amounted to anything with regards to Bitcoin, just because taking the legacy finance players out of your daily life is traditionally going to help the little guys, right? Shifting more to tech and less to legacy is helpful anyways, for everybody, I would say. But I think exactly what you're talking about is probably going to happen eventually, whether that's in 2 years or 5 years. And it kind of ties into the last two stories about how the regulatory clarity is really all that's left now, right? Because, you know, Jack Dorsey and Tim Cook or whatever, one of their other top guys from each company got together in a room, right? And there's not one chance that they didn't talk about Bitcoin, right? Because that's like Jack Dorsey's life mission now at this point, pretty much, right? So I think that this is huge for that reason, because this in combination with just things in the regulatory framework becoming more clear, I think we're going to see that next. And Bitcoin's kind of neat like that sometimes, because all you need is one piece of big news like this, and that could be what enough buying pressure that breaks whatever as Greg Foss would say, that the Wall Street algorithms that are keeping the correlation with Bitcoin and the NASDAQ, big news like this breaks that, right? And that's when you get the I think he calls it the gamma squeeze. So this is another one that credibility, it adds credibility to Bitcoin, right? As soon as that happens, even if there's not a lot of people in North America using it, right? Because I don't think a lot of North American people see no problem with just tapping their credit card or just using their fingerprint on their phone as is, right? But I think it adds the credibility. It's like, oh, Apple's getting into Bitcoin now too. Maybe I should look into it. And they might not ever use it for payments for many years, but that I think that's adds that credibility. And they say, okay, maybe I could have it in my portfolio. Maybe I should be buying it. Oh, it sure is going up a lot. What's happening there? You know what I mean? That type of thing. But I think once Bitcoin is integrated in this too, that's going to play a big thing in some of the smaller countries, right? In these countries in Africa and different things like that. Because I think even the way Bitcoin payments now work with Lightning, with scanning the QR and clicking send, adding a note and everything like that, that's too complicated, I think. We live in a world where every single click matters. If your internet glitches and delays by like 1 second, you're pissed, right? So I think that just being able to tap with your phone and pay with Bitcoin is a huge improvement to having to scan a QR and do more than one click, essentially, if that makes sense. But yeah, I think what you're saying is definitely the writing on the wall and definitely what's going to be happening.
No, I agree with you 100%. So, you know, right now, I think, I agree with you that it's like, it's kind of a hassle to like pull out your phone, then, okay, I got to open this app and then, you know, scan the QR and then pay through Bitcoin or get like a Lightning invoice. Like, it's just that added step. Whereas like now you go, you know, to I don't know, some store, you pull out your wallet, you put in the chip or your card or whatever, or you tap your phone and it's just instant. So I think Bitcoin has a lot of development to go through where, you know, those like second and third party apps where, you know, the payment rails just kind of become easier and more user-friendly. And I think once things kind of become more user-friendly, like people don't really care about what they're paying with, right? So if like, you go to a store and they say, oh, we only accept Bitcoin. Okay, well, if it's easy to pay in Bitcoin, like, I don't care. What does it matter if I do that, right? So, and like people already kind of do that with like various apps. So say like, you know, a Bitcoin app or a Bitcoin hot wallet, kind of like a Cash App becomes almost like a Starbucks app or something, you know, where it's like, okay, well, I go to the store, I know I have to use this Cash App and I could just kind of tap or do something really quick. And, you know, that's how I do it at this one place. I don't think that'll be like that big of a deal. And then maybe, you know, the merchants can start to incentivize users to use Bitcoin opposed to using just fiat dollars. Cause I'm already starting to see it. You know, I don't know how it is in Canada, but there's a couple places here, local, like smaller, you know, mom and pop shops, but they look at, you know, that they give me a bill and it's two separate bills. There's cash and then there's card. There's cash, debit card, and then credit card. So I have three different options of how much something costs. And so, you know, usually the cash is the lowest, debit's the next, and then credit card's the most expensive. And so I think like, you know, if you start to do that and add Bitcoin to that, maybe it'll lower prices even more. And especially in an inflationary time where everything's going up and expenses are going up, people will kind of gravitate towards that as long as, you know, as we're saying, it becomes lower and lower friction.
Yeah, I agree. I had a tweet about that when I was out east on vacation last month. But for the first time in my life in PEI, I saw gas stations that had on their big sign with the LED lights that everybody can see, the credit price and the debit price as different prices. And I had never seen that. I'd seen that for like mom and pop shops who would say like, well, pay cash and we'll give you a discount. But I'd never seen that for actually bigger, more legit companies like that. So I think we're gonna move more in that way, right? Because a lot of people don't want to raise prices if they feel like they shouldn't, or they feel like they can't, right? So they'll have to try and expand their margins in other ways, right? So they're looking at how much are they paying MasterCard each month, right? So then they're going to be giving these incentives to have people use cash or have people just use debit instead, or Bitcoin, right? Just to simplify their lives.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And yeah, my gas station too down the street from me is also doing the same thing where they're doing credit and cash, two different prices. So it's getting outrageous out there. And now I think in Florida, we're starting to see above $5 a gallon, which I think 2 years ago it was under two. So a lot of crazy times here. So everybody's going to find ways, I think, to save some money. But that brings me to my next story. This one I think is kind of interesting. So I kind of have maybe a differing opinion than most plebs, but I'd like to hear what you think about this. So Edge is a non-KYC custodial Bitcoin wallet, and they're releasing their first, quote, confidential Bitcoin MasterCard or credit card. So they're partnering with MasterCard to release this card, and it does not require any KYC data of any kind or any associated transaction fees. So there's a $20 fee to purchase the card, and then there's a $1,000 limit. But it'll be interesting to kind of see how this card works. So what is your kind of overall thoughts on this before I kind of go into my little rant?
Well, I have more questions, I think, than answers on this one. My first thought is just, can I get this in Canada? If it's KYC free, would they even know I'm in Canada? Right. That's kind of what I'm thinking. Or would it matter where I am? Would anyone know at all where I am when I'm applying for this card? So I hope I could do it. I'm going to have to look into it when I get some time, because it would be huge for me. Right. A lot of people don't realize the importance of privacy. Right. And maybe privacy isn't that important right now. Right. But a lot changes over time. Right. I'm 29 now. If I live another 70 years, and right now it seems like each passing government is getting more and more tyrannical and overreaching. What's going to happen in 50 years and 60 years, right? So I think this stuff will be more and more important. So what I'm happiest about is just that this is people innovating and growing this ecosystem and focusing on privacy, right? And then, of course, there's concerns with that, the kind of the same concerns that people have with regards to CBDCs and things like that. Restricting certain purchases, kind of that could be done now with credit cards, theoretically, right? If the government came down top down and told Visa and MasterCard, okay, people aren't allowed to buy X anymore, I'm pretty sure that'd be pretty easy to do, right? So I don't think we necessarily need a CBDC for that type of overreach and that type of like dictatorship, communism type stuff to start going on. Unless I'm missing something, I think everyone needs this card.
Yeah, so I think like it's good for the consumer, but at the end of the day, I don't know if I like, you know, I think like people are always kind of out to get or find the best deal or find ways around things, right? So there's a lot of stories going around now about, you know, squatters in the US and in other places and stuff too. But I think like, you know, for a business perspective, like how is Edge going to even make this work, right? Because if there's no KYC, there's no credit, there's nothing like that, like how are they going to make me pay it back? Like I can essentially then get a free $1,000. I can go spend it and then just pay $20 for it. And nobody would know. There would be no credit hit. There would be nothing like that. And then at the end of the day, like I could just toss the card away and just be like, hey, like I don't need this card anymore. And that's where I'm kind of like confused, where it's like, okay, like, cause there's no preloading that's required for it or anything like that. So I think that there's like a good, like, I think like it's a good concept, but I think like a lot of people, once they kind of figure this out, that they're going to take a lot of advantage of it just strictly because of like the non-preloading and nothing like that. Like, cause like what's stopping you? Like you said, like, can you get it in Canada? Like, okay, you can get it in Canada. Right. And then you lose the card. And then like what, you can't really like stop it or anything like that, cause it's non-KYC. Like I'm sure you have like some sort of an account or some way to kind of pay it back. But like, you know, if you never like log in or anything or activate it that way, like, I feel like there's a lot of ways that people can kind of get around this. And there's going to have to be like some sort of KYC, whether it's like connecting to an email or connecting to an existing bank account or even connecting to like maybe a Bitcoin wallet, which I think would be kind of interesting to see how that plays out. Like, okay, if they they require you to have an Edge wallet, which is also non-KYC. And then from there, you know, you have to have like a certain amount of, you know, Bitcoin or something else within that wallet in order to get that $1,000 limit. And I know that $1,000 limit is just kind of like regulatory stuff. Like they're not going to be able to go over that $1,000 for quite some time. But I think it'll be kind of interesting to see, you know, how this all plays out, because if you don't have to put any KYC information, theoretically, like not paying the bill has no credit impact or no like really negative effect. Like, you know, maybe Edge or MasterCard can like stop the card after obviously they can stop it after $1,000, but you know, what are they going to do? Are they going to come at you after you for that? Or like, how are they going to come for you? So I think like it's a good thought, and I think, you know, it's definitely something like moving forward, but I see the business perspective from it, and it just like, it kind of puts my mind in a pretzel. Like, what? It's better for the consumer, but like the business still needs to be able to run in order to kind of keep this going. And so like, how is that even going to work?
Yeah. So I could see the idea that you said, like maybe there's some sort of like, you have to use their wallet and prove that you have a certain amount of Bitcoin there, that maybe they have the keys to and could take if for non-payment or something like that. But to be honest, when I read this story, I assumed that it was prepaid. That would make more sense to me, is that it was prepaid. Because if it's not prepaid and they don't have, if they're not holding some of my corn, I'm going to steal $1,000 from Edge next month. because you're right. I will do that. I'm not joking. So hopefully they have that thought of somehow, because you're right. That doesn't make sense. I assume that they would have had that covered somehow. Otherwise, I am very bearish on Edge as a company.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm really looking at this story too, because it's kind of like, it's like tripping me up, because I've gone through it like a couple times, and it says like they have options to fund the account, but you don't necessarily need to do it, because it has like a daily load and spending limit of like $1,000. And so, yeah, it says Edge customers will not need to worry about preloading funds onto the card, as funds are sent instantaneously once a transfer is initialized. So I'm not really sure. I guess it's kind of like an Apple Pay or like a debit card maybe, where you need to preload it like that. But then like at the end of the day, then that's kind of KYC then, I feel like, because you have to load it with like a debit card or like a bank account. So I think like it's kind of like, it's like an interesting thought, but like, somebody's going to have your data somewhere along these rails. So it's just, yeah, like I agree with you there. Like, I think like there needs to be like some sort of, you know, I guess regulation behind it, and like not paying it back or anything like that. There's like really no penalties. So we'll see. I mean, I think like Edge is like kind of trying to be innovative with this. And I think it's interesting too, that they're partnering with MasterCard with it. So I know Visa and MasterCard have kind of like joined in with some of these crypto companies to, you know, create their credit cards. I know, you know, I have a BlockFi card that I use that gets, you know, 1.5% Bitcoin back. And I know that there's some other, you know, Bitcoin debit cards and credit cards that Master and Visa have too. So it seems like, although Bitcoin kind of, you know, goes against Visa and MasterCard and is cutting into their fees, they're also kind of playing into that ecosystem as well and like partnering with these companies. So I don't know. I mean, I think like overall, this whole thing is just, I think it's still kind of like confusing, and I don't see like a lot of like clarity as like, all right, this is definitely going to be the way and all that. I think there's still some question marks I have for some of these stories.
Yeah. I'm interested to learn more, though. I could see Daniel said apparently MasterCard has denied any involvement in this. That, if that's true, that's pretty funny. They want to be as far away from this as they can. I don't know if he's joking there, if that's true.
I think he's joking because I'm looking at this article from Bitcoin Magazine that like I but I mean take it for what you will. Like Bitcoin Magazine published this yesterday, and it just said like yeah that they're partnering with MasterCard. So we'll see. And like Edge has made an announcement from their company. So you know, I guess maybe it could be one of those things like Edge announced it and MasterCard is like, yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. So I don't know. I mean, Edge seems like it's one of these companies that's like kind of on the come up. I know that they're trying to do their non KYC, you know, Bitcoin wallet. And yeah, I mean, from all I've heard of people and users that use Edge is it's, you know, very user friendly and things like that too. And allows you to hold your own keys. Edge is actually one of the sponsors of the Tampa Bay Bitcoin meetup too. So, which is where I'm at. So, that's kind of how I got wind of this story, but I think it's like I said, it's like an interesting company. It's interesting to see how like a lot of these companies will play out and find ways to profit. Because I think like, you know, one thing about, you know, the fiat system and that kind of like mindset is like companies always had some sort of margin and some sort of built-in fee in order to allow the company to grow. Whereas like the Bitcoin ethos is like, you know, give everything for free, give the lowest fees, like a company like Strike. They do a lot of things like that. But, you know, in order for Strike to grow, like if Strike were to charge like, you know, a little bit more of a fee, like some of these other ones, like a Swan, I know charges like 1%, and some of these other ones charge like a little bit higher of a percent, they would grow obviously a lot quicker if people use that platform. So I think, you know, people will kind of gravitate to the best user interface and the lowest fees eventually, like once they get involved. But I think like this is kind of just an overall interesting concept. And Dan is also saying that Edge has officially disabled this card, which is interesting because like this whole thing was released yesterday on the 8th and we're recording this on the 9th. So if this is the case, this is a huge turnaround in less than 24 hours. So anyway, let's move on to the next story. So PayPal is now allowing their users to remove Bitcoin off their platform. So I think this is kind of like a similar story to how I see the tap to pay, because, you know, PayPal is a big finance giant. It allows people to, you know, pay businesses, accept payments, all that kind of stuff. I know a lot of businesses use PayPal similar to like a bank account. And so for me, it seems like this is kind of like another logical move for PayPal, because every other place now that you can buy Bitcoin and other cryptos to a lesser extent allows you to transfer Bitcoin off of their platform. And now PayPal will be doing the same. I believe that they're going to kind of be going into this in July, as I want to say, is when they're like rolling this out. And so it seems like they're just kind of trying to keep up with these other payment processors. They have kind of like a moat on older small businesses that have this, but it seems like they're realizing like, okay, like, shit, all these other places are getting into Bitcoin and all these other things that, and they need to continue on that route. So I think this could be another way where, you know, if you want to pay a business in Bitcoin, well, now maybe like instead of them just being able to buy it, they can like now buy and accept or accept and receive and send Bitcoin as well. So what are your kind of thoughts on that? Do you think like I'm on the same path as I was before, or do you think like PayPal is one of those companies that's just like kind of so old and just has done it for so long that they're going to take a lot longer than maybe an Apple and a Square?
I'm sure they'll take longer than Apple and Square, just because I have a lot less faith in PayPal as a brand and stuff like that. But I think they're on the right track, right? The fact they're doing this and all the benefits that you've said, I think are great. What I really like about stories like this, where it's kind of like an older company starting to move towards Bitcoin, and not only moving towards Bitcoin, but staying true to the Bitcoin ethos of self-custody, take your coin off of our app and hold it yourself. I like that because that means that there's who knows how many executives of PayPal actually tried this, right? And therefore have experienced self-custodying their own Bitcoin and their own Bitcoin wallet. We know like that kind of changes you when you realize like, I have this Bitcoin and nobody can take it away from me, right? So we know there's a lot of people at PayPal who now have experienced that. And I think the impressive thing about this is that the reason it's here is because the users demanded it, right? Which is interesting because normally people who are buying Bitcoin on PayPal before you could actually take it off of PayPal and take self-custody, I think they were just buying it because it was there, right? Not because they understood Bitcoin. But that means that they've now went further down the rabbit hole, right? And now they're realizing, okay, I should actually be self-custodying this. So I think that shows that us as the Bitcoin maxis are doing our job in educating people, right, and telling them to take custody. Because these guys demanded this from PayPal. Actually, same thing happened to a company in Canada. How I originally found out about Bitcoin, a company called Wealthsimple, and they allow you to pick your own stocks and things like that. But then they came out with their crypto platform with Bitcoin and Ethereum, and they sent out surveys to their customers saying like, what should we do next? And I voted, you should allow me to take my Bitcoin off of the app. And then whatever, 2 months later, then it was there, right? So that tells me that people around the world with these types of companies are saying, we want to take custody of our corn, which I think is pretty sweet. And I think beyond just like the regular education of telling people to take custody, I think kind of the Canadian truckers really helped with that too, because Trudeau there really inadvertently helped a lot of people make that big step. Right. So we kind of have him to thank, I think, for that is okay. People could steal my money, right? Or the government could tell me, no, I can't have this. So I think that's a big reason why people take self-custody. So I'm more bullish on that aspect of it rather than just how this affects payments and everything like that and merchants and everything like that. I'm just more confident that clearly there's a demand for people to control their own keys.
I agree with you there 100%. And I'm glad you brought up the truckers because I didn't want to get into it because I know it's kind of like a hairy subject over there. But I agree with you that it kind of just showed the Bitcoin use case like 100%. Like, and we'll kind of get into the next story kind of on the lines of CBDCs. But it just shows like the true power of Bitcoin. And I think I saw Ben, BTC Sessions kind of tweet out, I can't remember the exact number, but it was a significant amount of payments that were made in Bitcoin to these truckers has never been confiscated, although they tried to confiscate a lot too. So, you know, it's just like, it's just showing the power of it right there. And I agree with you. It's like, not your keys, not your coins. And we have somebody in the chat talking about, you know, donating there. So Romel said his neighbor donated to the truckers and literally withdrew his whole bank account and put it in his safe in his home. And he's still out of work since he had a job with the government. So a lot of fucked up things happened because of that. And, you know, Romel, praying for your neighbor there. Hopefully he finds a job or something like that. And I also saw, you know, Plate Liquor's hiring. So maybe he's got something where he can help. But yeah, I mean, it's just like all these countries and like governments kind of being pretty tyrannical. Like recently, I think it's just the COVID crisis kind of just gave everybody, you know, a little taste. And I think that's kind of elevated the use case for Bitcoin and in kind of turn has made people more bullish and has brought more people onto it, whether it's like the money printing or the control aspect. I think, you know, 2020 was a very, very big year for Bitcoin, and it was kind of like an unintended big year. But, you know, like you said, some of these policies have unintended consequences. And I think that was one of the unintended consequences is it showed a lot of these Bitcoin use cases. And so let's get into this next policy, or policies. So I saw this article where 105 countries are exploring the use of CBDCs. So that's a very, very significant number. It represents 95% of the global GDP. And it's like 50 countries are in the advanced phase of exploration, meaning they're in the development, pilot, or launch. And currently there's 10 countries that have launched the currency, with China being the biggest country, and it's looking to expand its CBDC in 2023. Some notable countries in the development stage of the CBDC are South Korea, Japan, India, and Russia. And so what is your overall opinion of CBDCs and all these countries kind of exploring it? Do you think it's kind of par for the course and expected, or do you think like it's just going to kind of push the average person more towards Bitcoin?
So I'm kind of two minds. Part of me is actually like really scared of CBDCs, and I in the past have avoided thinking about it, to be honest, because I don't want to go down that rabbit hole in my mind and think what will happen. But then on the other side, I think it depends on the timing of it. And it really underscores the importance of, we think it's like fun and kind of cool to introduce people to Bitcoin, but I think CBDCs are the real reason why us as early Bitcoiners, it's very important to us to really orange pill our friends and family and as many people as we can. Because if the CBDC comes and becomes mandatory before there's widespread adoption or at least knowledge of Bitcoin, like it's kind of too late almost, you know what I mean? If people don't have a way of buying Bitcoin, then it makes things a lot harder for us. So I think it's like, this should be our motivation to really get out there and tell our friends and family, like, this isn't about making money. This is serious, and this could potentially be life or death, right? There's all the standard things that people say about CBDCs, and they say, okay, well, if there's more like COVID type stuff, quarantines, they could enforce that, because then you can't go buy stuff outside of the time that you're supposed to be in the house and things like that. And it ties right into the last thing about the truckers and your story about your neighbor there. Because the same thing happened with my family members too. As soon as the Emergency Act was invoked, I texted basically my whole family, right? My mom, my sister, my dad, and kind of said, take money out of the bank. You should have money that accessible. You need enough money in cash to at least bribe a border guard to let you cross the border, right? And that was my thinking. And I would still stand by that, right? It seems like these restrictions have been eased, but who knows if they're coming back this winter, right? If things cool down, it's like, oh, cases are worse, right? So you never know what's coming back. CBDCs, that's like one of the good things about having an extra incompetent government like we do in Canada, is they'll probably be slow with it, I hope. So hopefully we have another 3-5 years where we can really kind of get that Bitcoin life raft to the people that matter most to us and to as many people as we can. Because if you have Bitcoin, a CBDC shouldn't scare you, right? Like I said before, you can't regulate my Bitcoin. Like the government might be able to regulate my neighbor's Bitcoin if he doesn't know what he's doing or didn't take self-custody. You can't regulate mine, right? You can't force me to use a CBDC. So that's what I'd say is it's kind of terrifying, but it does definitely provide a strong use case for Bitcoin. But I think it really should light a fire underneath all of our asses that orange pilling is not something we should do. It's something we have to do, and it's really it's up to us, right? Because we're the ones who know what's going on, and other people just don't at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you there too, and I think like the biggest thing is, like, I don't know if that was the vibe in Canada before, but I know in the United States people always think, this can't happen to us. Like, I know there's a big kind of issue right now around guns and everything like that, and it's kind of becoming politicized, and they're like, okay, you know, the people need to take the guns away on one side, and other people are like, well, I need my guns on the other side. And it's like, you know, I kind of view it as just like overall just freedom of all this stuff. Like, there needs to be, you know, maybe some regulation on some things, but at the end of the day, like, you know, to be like a free and sovereign country, you need to like trust the people of the country to make the right decision, right? So I think like these CBDCs are extremely scary, and I think everybody in America, in Canada, and like anywhere that they maybe thought that this could never happen should really have opened their, like the whole Canadian trucker situation should have really opened their eyes and really just been like, okay, well, you know what, either like you're in Canada, I know a lot of people in the chat are in Canada, or like you're in the United States and it happened just north of us. Like if this can happen in Canada, very well could happen in the United States. And so that's where you need to kind of have your mindset at, is like, okay, well, you know, your home is, you pay for it in taxes. So it's, although, you know, you might own the home and you might have paid off your mortgage completely, it's still, you know, not necessarily your home. Like the government can take that away if they want, but they can't take away your Bitcoin, you know, as long as you kind of store that, you know, the way you, should be, like non-KYC and all that kind of stuff. And there's other ways to kind of get around it, you know, that's another rabbit hole. But anyway, there's ways to kind of protect yourself in that aspect. And I think, you know, that instance and, you know, this whole, you know, COVID pandemic and everything like that has kind of opened a lot of people's eyes where now they're waking up and they're like, okay, like this freedom aspect of Bitcoin is even bigger than just, you know, the hard money principles of it. It's more so, you know, the freedom and the anonymous aspect of it. I can't really say that word, but, and I think that will kind of just keep everything moving forward. And, you know, I'm extra bullish on the space going forward, even though we're kind of like in a bear market now. I'm getting more people, you know, coming up to me and asking me about Bitcoin just because they know like I do this kind of stuff. So, I think the CBDC will kind of push more people towards Bitcoin, but it'll be like a kind of initial bad shock, or maybe it'll be like, hey, you need this CBDC in order to pay for, you know, maybe a ticket, or you need the CBDC in order to pay for groceries or something like that. So I don't know. We'll see. I mean, we'll see. Have to see how much like it's regulated, how much is it accepted. But I think, you know, slowly but surely, these governments are kind of trying to take away people's freedom. And that should be something that should really be alarming to a lot of people globally.
Yeah, I think, yeah. So there's a lot about this to talk about. I think all governments can do is take away people's freedom, right? Because anything that they try to do with good intentions has the unintended consequences, but every single law, every single bill that's passed just takes away somebody's freedom, right? And I think Bitcoin is the complete opposite to that, because all government does is it takes whatever, a week to add something, and then that law is basically permanently there. It's very hard to take something away as far as laws go, right? Very easy to add, right? And it's kind of beautiful that Bitcoin is the complete opposite of that, where it's very hard to add something to Bitcoin, right? It's very hard to get a new change passed. So by default, it's staying the same, right? As opposed to changing and growing with the complexity and the regulations and stuff like that. So I think it's kind of complete opposites in that way. Which I think is pretty great.
Yeah, I agree with you there. And, you know, Rommel also made another point where they can make the CBDC have like an expiry date. So you have to spend it to kind of inflate the economy artificially, which is a point like I never even really thought of, like maybe putting an expiration date on, you know, your cash. And that's an even scarier aspect of it. So let's move away from the scary aspect. I'll ask you two questions to kind of wrap it up. So Bitcoin going forward, bullish, bearish, and why?
Do you mean like short term?
Let's say for the next, I don't know, next 2 years.
Yeah. I didn't stop you earlier when you said that you kind of matter of fact said that we're in a bear market. But I disagree with that. I think that we are in a market that is currently trading with the NASDAQ, right? And I think we all know that Bitcoin now is a leading indicator, right? I used to look at futures every morning or every night to say, okay, what's going on with the markets tomorrow? What do I got to tell my clients? Now I just look at the price of Bitcoin at 6 a.m. because that predicts better where the stock market's going to go, right? So we saw Bitcoin, whatever month it was, start to drop from its all-time high. And then it was like, I think a couple months later before the NASDAQ really started to go too, right? And then there's the whole Luna debacle, rising rates, everything like that. So I think that's why we've seen this big dip, right? I don't think we're actually in a bear market as far as like the halving cycles go and everything like that. I do think that any day now it's going to be something like Apple and Block all of a sudden doing Bitcoin or something like that. That's just going to be enough to have enough people smash by that. If it breaks the algos on Wall Street, right? That's when there's the gamma squeeze, right? And then when people see the gamma squeeze, when they see that the big green candle, right? That's when people now are FOMOing, which drives more green candles. So I think we're going to see another all-time high. And people kind of scoff at people when they say that nowadays, but Tim Draper's saying it, right? Tim Draper was early in Hotmail, right? And early in Tesla. And he's extreme Bitcoin bull now. He wears Bitcoin socks for God's sakes, right? And he's saying, this is a billionaire saying that we're not, that's still a bull market. So scoff if you want, but I think we're seeing all-time highs this year.
Hey, I hope I'm wrong. But I mean, also, I don't know, maybe if I'm right, we're just scooping up some cheap sats too. So I think there's positives to both. Like the bull run will get more people in, but also I do enjoy this time getting Bitcoin at a price where I think we might not see it ever again in the next couple of years too. So yeah, now last and final question. You've kind of like alluded to some of your interactions in the Bitcoin space, but what is your craziest Bitcoin interaction that you've had, like just being on Bitcoin Twitter? And then I want you to tell me a little bit about that news clip that I saw that used to be pinned on your Twitter, but I see now that it's not. But they called you the plate licking pleb on I don't know, maybe a talk show or something or what it was. But yeah, go into those things.
So things happen fast in Bitcoin. So I'll talk about that first, and then I'll talk about, because that's probably the coolest thing. But I had something more recently that's interesting as well. So what that was back in January, Mike Novogratz had his stupid tattoo of the wolf howling at the moon. And by then it's like, okay, if you have this much money and you don't understand, you don't see a shitcoin for what it is, right? So my knee-jerk reaction was just to tweet and say, this is going to be so embarrassing in like 6 months. And so I tweeted that and then thought nothing of it. But then like maybe a month ago or 2 months ago, someone tweeted at me and said, hey, plate licker, Liz Clement or Clement or however the hell you say that, just mentioned you on stage at the Security Token Summit with Tim Draper. And I was like, what? Like, is this a scammer? Like, what's going on here? I didn't think anything of it. But then all of a sudden there was a video of it that XRP shitcoiner posted. they talked about it. It's actually a good talk to watch. They talked for 40 minutes of an interview. But then somewhere they started talking about Luna. And then she said, oh yeah, I read the replies. And then she mentioned my tweet there, which is pretty awesome. Things happen fast in Bitcoin. So it's actually really funny that popped up and that it blew up like that, because it's like instantly I have like 1,000 more followers. And then just, I probably argued like 1,000 XRP guys that day because of the one big account that shared it. So that was really cool. It'd be hard to say that that's not like the coolest story in Bitcoin. But I will talk about more recently. Never thought this would happen, but actually earlier on today I was on a Teams call with Greg Foss, and that wasn't recorded. It's not for a podcast or anything like that. It's actually just because I asked him for help. If I basically want to start orange pilling the company I work for. I've secured a meeting with our chief investment strategist next Wednesday, and so I'm going to be presenting to him some of those, the Fidelity reports that Yuri and Timur put out. But then also I want to talk about If you guys don't know, Greg Foss's kind of main thesis is Bitcoin as credit default swaps and what he calls the fulcrum index, where you kind of look at basically sovereign debt and Bitcoin acting as insurance on that debt. And basically where that ends up is, okay, Bitcoin should be at least a 1-3% allocation to any bond portfolio, which I personally agree with. So I'm likely going to be talking about that as well next week. But it was really kind of surreal thinking like, okay, a year and 4 months ago, when I was just becoming a maxi, I was listening to Greg Foss, and he's like really making things click in my head. And then to think that now, today, he sent me an email asking for my cell phone number. So it's really cool how small of a world that it is here. So that's what I would say to everybody here is just message people. If you want to get something going and you need help with something, I would send a DM or send the tweets, because things tend to take off. A lot of people in Bitcoin are giving their time and energy and their expertise for free because they want to see Bitcoin succeed. And that's a very powerful human emotion. So I think if you want to interview someone bigger on your podcast, if you want to start a meetup, if you need a sponsor for something, I would just send the DMs or send the tweets and ask, because I think you'll be really surprised of what actually happens. Foss is the hardest worker in Bitcoin, in my opinion.
Yeah, Foss is a great advocate for Bitcoin, and he's awesome. And I agree with you 100% there too. That's been my experience. So I just want to echo that sentiment. If anybody, you know, wants to reach out to anybody, I've, you know, gotten very positive responses. In Bitcoin especially, because I have two podcasts. So one's like more on the like FinTwit side, and that I have a little bit harder time getting guests. But Bitcoin, never. I always have people kind of connecting me to other people, saying interview this, and people sending me people's information too. So it's always been the Bitcoin Twitter and Bitcoin space has been very, very positive. And I agree with you there. A lot of people are giving their time for free just because they want to see it succeed. So on that note, I know, we've ran a little bit over, but Platelicker, I really appreciate your time tonight. Why don't you, sign us off and tell people where they can find you and what you got going on in the Bitcoin space. I know we talked a little bit about the meetup, but why don't you give that information again too?
Yeah, so I'm at Platelicker_21 on Twitter. That's my only Bitcoin social media presence. I'm a NIM there. But what I have going on is the big one is the meetup coming in July. So keep an eye out if you're in the Toronto area, because I'm going to be tweeting about the location, nailing down the exact time of day. It's going to be big. It's going to be the biggest one yet, putting the most resources behind it and everything like that. But if you're not in the area, still keep an eye out, because we are making a big announcement. I shouldn't say we. It's not necessarily me. I'm just I've been lucky enough to kind of facilitate it. But there's going to be a big announcement for Bitcoiners in Canada about something cool going on later this year. So that's July 16th in Toronto. It's a Saturday. But follow me on Twitter, shoot me a DM or a tweet, and looking forward to meet you all.
Platelicker, thank you so much. Thank you so much for your time. July 16th, everybody in Canada should be there. Make the trip to Toronto. I don't know how far that is, but it seems like a central location in Canada. So everybody make the trip and go. It sounds like there's a big announcement. So I'm really excited to hear about that. And hopefully we can convince Joey and Lynn and those other guys to start promoting that as well. So on that note, Platelicker, thank you so much for your time. And we'll be in contact. I'll be following you. And everybody who isn't following them, go follow Platelicker_21. So. All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.